Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission, as always, is to take really foundational, sometimes pretty complex source material and, well, pull out the core ideas, the stuff that shapes our world.
Yeah, we try to cut through the noise, give you that deeper context you need to feel, you know, genuinely informed.
And today, we're tackling something. Well, it's heavy. Definitely relevant, though.
It is. We're looking at a philosophical proposal, a really deep one, that doesn't just criticize politics as we know it. It actually argues for redefining the whole concept of the political.
Le politique, as the source calls it.
Exactly. And the core idea is stark. Our historical grasp of what politics is and what it should do is fundamentally broken.
And that broken understanding is driving, well, centuries of failure, according to that.
Catastrophic failure, yeah. That's the premise.
Okay, so let's unpack that failure. We're not just talking about the usual grumbling, you know, I don't like the current government. This runs much deeper.
Oh, absolutely. This is systemic. The source argues that the political as an institution is just widely discredited today, and it points to some pretty harsh realities.
Like what, specifically?
Well, look at established democracies first. You see election results. Someone wins, maybe even by a good margin.
Right.
But dig a bit deeper. In many countries, the single largest group isn't supporters of Party A or Party B. It's the people who abstain, who don't vote.
That's a powerful point. Millions, sometimes tens of millions, are just opting out.
Exactly. The source sees that as demonstrating this huge structural, well, disillusionment, maybe manipulation too. People just don't feel like voting is a real way to influence things anymore.
Okay, so that's the situation in democracies, or supposed democracies. What about places ruled by force?
Well, there or in places where democracy is crumbling, it's even more direct. Power isn't maintained by consent, not even passive consent. It's just raw institutionalized violence.
The state itself becomes the threat.
Precisely. The very apparatus meant to protect becomes the source of systemic terror.
But this isn't new, is it? The source says this skepticism, this distrust of the state, is ancient. It's not just a modern social media phenomenon.
Not at all. It goes way back. The source points to the oldest written records we have, early Egyptian texts.
And what do they show?
Often, descriptions of pharaohs focus on their wars, their aggression. Leaders defined by conquest and ego, maybe not so much by good governance.
And then later, Greece and Rome. The birthplaces of democracy.
Even then, as soon as you get political writing in Athens or Rome, you immediately get complaints about corruption, about demagogues manipulating the people.
People worried about leaders putting personal gain above the public good? That sounds familiar.
Doesn't it? They were always comparing their current flawed leaders to some idealized past figure. It's a constant theme.
Which leads us, maybe inevitably, to the 20th century. The source calls it the ultimate demonstration of political failure.
Yeah, it's put very starkly, an unparalleled, murderous demonstration of the political's capacity for harm. And the key difference then was technology. It wasn't just spears and swords anymore, it was industrialized killing. Amplified destruction on a massive scale. Genocides, world wars, ideological purges, all enabled by new, centralized, technologically advanced methods of control and violence.
A terrifying thought. And if the 20th century was about that kind of violence, how does the source characterize our current millennium?
The big failure now, it argues, is a collective refusal to act, specifically on the huge existential threats.
Climate change, pollution, ecosystem collapse.
Exactly. A global failure to implement any meaningful shared action against threats that, you know, completely ignore borders.
And this failure threatens, well, everyone.
Everything.
It threatens the survival of our own species and countless others. It's perhaps the ultimate political failure because the political system globally has proven incapable of managing it.
So the big question, why this constant failure? Is it just, you know, people are greedy, power corrupts, we pick bad leaders?
The source says no. Those explanations are too simple. They don't get to the root of it.
So what is the root, according to this analysis? This is the really radical part. The core thesis is that the fundamental opposition isn't good versus evil, or right versus left, or even rich versus poor.
Okay.
It's an opposition between knowledge and ignorance.
Knowledge and ignorance. How does that apply to politics?
Political actors, and that includes citizens, theorists, everyone involved, fail because they are essentially advancing blindly. They don't actually know what the legitimate job of politics is.
They don't understand its proper sphere of action or the right tools to use.
Precisely. We're all operating under a fundamentally flawed map of what the political is supposed to do, and maybe even more importantly, what it's not supposed to touch.
Wow. Okay, so the mission then, the goal of this whole analysis is to break that cycle of failure.
Yes. And the first step, the absolute crucial step, is to correctly identify the political's legitimate playground. We need to rigorously define what the source calls the public thing, la chose publique.
That definition is the knowledge we need to escape the ignorance.
That's the idea.
All right, so that brings us to the framework. To define this public thing, we need to distinguish it from two other fundamental concepts.
Right, the natural thing and the private thing.
And the source has strong words for the common idea that everything is political.
It calls it devastating.
Why devastating? Seems like a common activist slogan.
Because if everything is political, it means the political apparatus feels justified in intervening everywhere, in every aspect of life.
And that's how it loses its way and its legitimacy.
Exactly. It becomes totalizing. There's no space left that's autonomous from political interference.
So to build this framework, the source actually goes back and critiques a very famous idea from classical philosophy. From Ciceron.
Yeah, this is a key point. Ciceron, the Roman statesman and orator,
right.
He defined the state, the commonwealth, the res publica, which literally means the public thing.
Right, as the thing of the people, res populi. It's res publica, res populi. I remember that from school.
That's the one. And the source argues this definition, seemingly intuitive, was actually a fatal error.
Fatal? Why? What's wrong with saying the state belongs to the people?
The problem is subtle but profound. It argues that by shifting from the concrete idea of the public, the infrastructure, the shared services, the open spaces, to the much fuzzier concept of the people, political thinking got lost. It went into quicksand.
Quicksand? How so?
Because the very idea of the people, populous, as a coherent interacting group, actually depends on having a secure public space first. You can't define the public thing using a concept that requires the public thing to even exist. It's circular.
Ah, okay. So if the state is just whatever the people want, then the people could theoretically decide to, say, dismantle the essential public infrastructure itself, and that would be politically legitimate under that definition.
Exactly. It muddies the waters. It prevents us from drawing clear lines around what political power is actually responsible for maintaining. It lets the political invade private life in the name of the people's will or neglect fundamental structures.
And this confusion, this definitional slip, has caused centuries of problems, according to the source.
Centuries of conceptual dead ends, yeah. All because we started with a subjective collective instead of an objective structure.
Okay, so let's define those objective structures. The three spaces. Started with A, the natural thing, the space of liberties.
Right. This is the baseline, the original unmanaged space. Its defining feature is a total absence of rules or guarantees.
Which makes it inherently insecure.
Totally insecure. Open, chaotic, risky.
And that insecurity isn't just for the weak, right?
No, it's universal. The source makes that clear. It's insecure for the prey, obviously, but also for the predator. The predator faces rivals, disease, accidents, environmental changes. It's maximum freedom, but also maximum risk for absolutely everything in it.
And the key dynamic here is that it's the source of constant renewal. It always pushes back.
Always. It inevitably resurges and breaks down the limits that we try to impose with our private and public spaces.
Like ocean waves wearing down seawalls.
Or earthquakes shifting borders, or, you know, climate change rewriting the map of where we can live. The natural inevitably reclaims ground from human attempts at permanent enclosure.
And the source extends this idea beyond the physical world.
Yes, beautifully, I think. Into the virtual or conceptual realm. Think about unregulated creativity, scientific exploration into the unknown, artistic invention.
That initial spark before rules and structures are imposed.
Exactly. That risk-taking outside of safe, established boundaries is described as the crucible of all literature, all art, and probably all work. True invention happens there precisely because there are no guarantees. It's pure adventure into chaos.
So if it's the source of all this creativity and renewal, what's the political limit? Can politics engage with it?
The key limit is the natural space cannot be regulated or protected by the political.
What about national parks, nature reserves? Aren't those political protections?
The moment you try to protect it or turn it into a reserve, the source argues, you're actually converting it into a form of the public space. You're creating managed boundaries enforced by political rules. It's no longer purely natural.
So the political's job isn't to manage the natural, but to what? Keep it separate.
To hold it at a distance. To prevent its inherent chaos from overwhelming the regulated spaces, the private and the public. It's about maintaining the boundary,
right.
Not controlling what's beyond it.
Okay. That makes sense. Now let's contrast that with its opposite. Be the private thing, the space of goods. This is all about limits.
Exactly. Defined by enclosures and closures. The very act of making something private is drawing a line, building a wall, setting a boundary.
And this applies across the board.
From a rabbit's burrow or a wolf's territory to a suburban house with a fence or a company's secure R&D lab, the purpose is always the same.
Mm.
Secure the individuals and their goods within that boundary.
And what does this drive socially and economically?
It leads to the accumulation of goods because they're protected. And it encourages sedentarization people settling down to manage and produce within their secure space.
And it operates by the rules of the market.
Yes. Since it's about the protection and exchange of goods, the market becomes the dominant force. The source even calls it an economic selection process, kind of like natural selection, but based on competition for resources within these secured zones.
Okay, but here's a tricky part. We often associate the private sphere with liberties, freedom of enterprise, freedom of thought, property rights. The source calls this a counter-truth. Why?
Because the defining feature of the private space isn't liberty in the chaotic, natural sense. It's security.
Security isn't liberty.
Not in the same way. Security, by definition, aims to prevent misadventure, loss, and external interference. It inherently discourages the kind of unbounded, risky adventure that defines the natural space.
So building high walls protects you, but it also limits your exposure to the truly unknown.
Precisely. The private sphere is geared towards stability, predictability, reproducing the same within its safe boundaries. It's about control, not pure, untamed freedom.
So if someone within that secure private space wants to access that natural kind of freedom, like a scientist trying to make a breakthrough,
they have to effectively open up a natural space inside their private enclosure. The scientist in the secure, privately funded lab ventures into conceptual chaos, taking intellectual risks. The private space provides the safety net, the resources, but the act of discovery itself is a leap into the unregulated natural realm of ideas.
That's a fascinating distinction. Security versus liberty. Okay, this perfectly sets up the third crucial space, C, the public thing. The space of exchanges.
Right. This is the linchpin, the necessary bridge, the interface between the other two.
And it borrows qualities from both.
Exactly. It's regulated and secured, like the private space. But crucially, it remains open, like the natural space, an open, secure platform.
And its function is defined by what it contains.
Works, overages, and services. These aren't goods to be bought and sold like in the private sphere. Their purpose is to facilitate and protect exchanges between private entities.
Like a road. Use the road to transport private goods, but the road itself isn't supposed to be a commodity.
Exactly. Oh. Or a shared language. Or a library. Or the internet's basic protocols.
The source divides these into two types.
Yeah. Common ways and common houses.
Common ways being?
Physical infrastructure, roads, bridges, ports, canals, but also, very importantly, virtual networks, communication lines, search engines, ideally neutral ones, open data standards, the pathways for exchange.
And common houses.
These are the shared places, public squares, parks, maybe shared community buildings, but also intangible things like languages, museums, libraries, theaters, places and systems for shared experience and knowledge access.
So the public thing is essentially the shared infrastructure, both physical and conceptual, that allows private spaces to interact safely and effectively.
Precisely. It's what enables the superposition of scenes that the source talks about. Without this secure, open interface, private interactions would be isolated, inefficient, or probably just break down to conflict. It gives value to the private by connecting it.
Okay, accepting these definitions, natural, private, public, changes everything for politics. The public thing creates the need for the political.
And it strictly limits it. The core function, the only legitimate function of the political, is to act as the manager and defender of this public thing, the interface.
So the job description is very specific.
Extremely specific. Build, maintain, open, and secure the common ways and common houses. That's it.
And the implication is huge.
Yeah.
Everything else is outside its jurisdiction.
And everything else. That's the radical limiting principle.
Wow. Okay, so the government cannot intervene in the private market, setting prices, controlling production.
Nope. That's private space dynamics.
And it cannot intervene in natural affairs. Life, death, ecological processes, beyond maintaining the boundary.
Also outside its scope. Natural space dynamics.
But hang on. If the political isn't managing the economy or providing social safety nets, what happens when people are suffering? If the market fails them, if there's poverty.
That's exactly the point the source makes. It argues that most political actions we see today, regulations, welfare programs, economic interventions, even sometimes organized violence, are attempts to compensate for a failure in managing the public thing.
So instead of ensuring good roads, open communication, and secure public spaces for everyone, they're trying to patch up problems downstream.
Yes. Applying social band-aids that are outside the political's legitimate sphere, which, the source argues, often just makes things worse in the long run. It's acting out of ignorance of its true role.
So things like minimum wage, unemployment benefits, state pensions, maybe even government-run health care, these are illegitimate political actions.
According to the source, yes. They're seen as intrusions into the private or natural spheres, usually necessitated because the public thing isn't functioning correctly to guarantee autonomy in the first place.
But isn't the goal to help people?
The argument is that the way to help people is to guarantee a functioning, open, secure public thing where everyone can live, move, and exchange freely. If that's guaranteed, the private market can function healthily within its bounds, and the natural space is respected, kept at bay.
And intervening directly in private matters just messes things up.
Leads to demotivation, inefficiency, economic problems, because the political is operating blindly outside its area of competence and legitimacy.
This completely flips how we think about government legitimacy. We usually focus on how power was gained, elections, revolution, inheritance.
The source basically says that's secondary. Legitimacy comes only from performance. Is the government successfully guaranteeing and improving the public thing? Is it ensuring private spaces are autonomous? Is it holding the natural space at a distance?
If it does that job well, it's legitimate, no matter how it came to power.
That's the provocative claim. And conversely, if it fails that job, it loses legitimacy, even if it was democratically elected.
Let's talk about losing legitimacy then. What are some concrete examples today?
A key one is allowing the public thing, especially the vital virtual common ways, to be privatized.
Like internet infrastructure, search engines, social platforms.
Exactly. If critical communication networks become private monopolies, if access to information is controlled by profit-driven companies, if you're forced onto private toll roads, digital or physical, for basic movement and exchange, the government is failing its core duty. It's letting the public thing decay or be captured.
And we already established it gains no legitimacy by meddling in private affairs, even with good intentions.
Right. That's always seen as an ignorant, destructive overreach. The political manages the interface. It ensures you can exit your private space back into the public commons freely. That freedom of exit is crucial for autonomy. The private space controls entry, but the public guarantees exit.
What about geography? We tend to equate the public thing with the nation state, within its borders.
The source challenges that too. Defining things by their borders is characteristic of the private space. My land ends here. The public thing is defined by the network of works and services.
So sovereignty applies to the network, not just the land.
Yes. Political responsibility follows the chose public wherever it extends. Administrative borders are needed for practical things like taxes, defense, sure, but they don't define the political's core task.
Can you give an example of the public thing crossing borders?
Sure. Think of a major international shipping port, technically located in one country, but serving as a vital hub for many, maybe even landlocked, nations. Or think about the global agreements and infrastructure needed to make international phone calls or the internet work.
Political action has to secure that network, regardless of where the servers or cables physically are.
Precisely. Secure the network, secure the exchange, that's the job.
There's a key concept here. Valorization, creating value. How did that fit in?
Value, in this view, emerges when people can move freely and frequently between the three spaces, natural, private, public. This constant movement forces the superposition of scenes.
Superposition of scenes, like different contexts overlapping.
Yeah. Private activity interacts with public infrastructure, which buffers against the natural environment. The more interaction, the more overlap, the more dynamic the system, the more value is created.
And if the political fails, if it messes up the public thing or invades the private,
it reduces these overlaps, these superpositions, the system devalorizes. Society loses overall value, even if a few individuals seem wildly successful for a while. That success often masks a general decline.
Okay, this rigorous framework leads us to the really prescriptive part. The proposals for a functioning political system. The source calls it a utopia.
It does, explicitly, because it's a radical departure.
So how does this utopian system actually secure that citizen autonomy we've been talking about? There are two main propositions.
Right. The first focuses on the essential tools for exchange. languages.
Proposition 1. Transmission of universal languages, the elementary cycle. Makes sense. Languages are part of the public thing.
Absolutely. So the political has a core responsibility. Identify the truly foundational languages and ensure they are transmitted to everyone, especially in early childhood.
And this is different from job training or higher education.
Completely different. This is about providing the basic toolkit that makes all future choices and interactions possible. It's foundational, enabling autonomy. It's not about specialized skills for a particular profession.
And because it's foundational, this curriculum has to be compulsory, non-negotiable.
Yes. Everyone needs these tools to navigate the public thing effectively.
So what languages are on this mandatory list?
They're grouped into three categories. First, languages of the world.
Which means?
Mathematics. And its logical and computer science derivatives. The universal language of structure, quantity, logic, essential for understanding reality in a structured way.
Okay, second category.
Languages of communities. Okay. This is what we usually think of as language. Your native tongue, the common language of your society, but also, crucially, international languages for broader communication. Tools for social exchange.
Makes sense. And the third category is the most surprising. Languages of the five senses.
This is maybe the most radical part of the educational proposal. Mandatory, foundational training in using and understanding all five senses.
So, visual arts, drawing, maybe appreciating film or photography?
Yes. And sound arts. Music theory, singing, playing a harmonic instrument like a piano or guitar, understanding rhythm through percussion.
Touch arts.
Modeling, sculpture, dance, yeah. Understanding form, space, movement.
Taste.
Cuisine, understanding flavor, ingredients, process.
And smell.
It's included as one of the five, though the specifics of the language there are less defined in the source.
Yeah.
But the principle is mastery of all sensory inputs.
Okay, I have to ask, why are arts and cooking considered fundamental political languages alongside math and English? Isn't this massive overreach into personal taste?
It ties directly back to the core problem.
Yeah.
Ignorance. The source argues political actors and citizens act blindly, partly because they lack the perceptual tools to grasp complex reality.
How does learning music theory help you make better political decisions?
Training the senses is training the ability to perceive nuance, proportion, harmony, synthesis, complex interactions, things that go beyond just abstract logic or data.
So, someone trained in sculpture understands spatial relationships differently. Someone trained in cooking understands complex systems and chemistry.
That's the idea. This broad sensory training equips people to better evaluate the quality of things in the world, including the works in the public thing, to recognize imbalance or disproportion, to perceive reality more fully. It makes them less susceptible to simplistic demagogic messages that prey on sensory and intellectual bluntness.
So education isn't just about job skills. It's about fundamental perceptual autonomy.
Wow. But again, the political role is limited. It ensures basic literacy in these languages. Can you read music, draw a recognizable form, follow a recipe, understand basic harmony?
But it's not responsible for making you a professional artist or chef.
No. That advanced specialization is a private pursuit, maybe using public resources like libraries or workshops, but driven by individual choice and enterprise within the private thing.
Okay, that clarifies the limit. Now, the second pillar of this utopia, the economic structure. Proposition 2, universal offer of public work, the quantum system.
Right. This is the mechanism to guarantee economic autonomy. The political's main tool is public work.
Which is?
Service dedicated only to building, maintaining, and operating the public thing. Nothing else.
And this must be universally available.
A universal offer. Available to everyone, adaptable to different ages and abilities. Crucially, it's offered, never imposed. It has to be a genuine choice.
And the goal is to let people live autonomously, use the public space, but with enough time left over for their own private stuff. Learning, business, hobbies, family.
Exactly. It provides an immediate, accessible alternative to being solely dependent on the private job market.
How does it work, this quantum structure?
The quantum is the basic unit of public work. The amount of work in one quantum is calculated precisely to cover all elementary needs.
All needs. What does that include?
Both natural needs, food, basic housing, clothing, essential health care, and social needs, access to training, information, and even basic entertainment or distraction. Everything required for a dignified, autonomous life.
Okay, wait. If the political can't intervene in private health care markets or provide pensions, how does this quantum system handle things like illness or old age?
It aims to make the traditional welfare state unnecessary. If everyone is guaranteed a baseline income through their optional public work quantum, and that income covers essentials, including healthcare access, perhaps provided as a public service funded by public work,
then you don't have systemic crises of unemployment, poverty, or lack of healthcare that require massive, complex state intervention and taxation schemes.
That's the logic. Healthcare, basic training, information access, these become services integrated into the secure public thing, supported by the public work system, available to all quantum participants.
It's a radical simplification. How much work is one quantum? Are we talking 40 hours a week?
No, far less. The goal isn't to replace private work entirely. The source suggests, based on potential efficiency, that one quantum might be something like 2 hours per day.
2 hours a day.
Or maybe two standard 7-hour days per week. Mm. Or averaged out about 104 days per year, a limited commitment.
Why so little?
Because the purpose is to guarantee the base for autonomy, leaving ample time for people to pursue private enterprise, education, family life, creativity, or just enjoy the natural space. It's about enabling freedom, not just substituting one boss for another.
Okay, but if one quantum covers all basic needs with just, say, 14 hours of work a week, how do you incentivize people to do more? Why would anyone take on complex, demanding public roles? Who manages the system?
Through a non-linear reward structure. This is designed to make greater commitment exponentially more attractive than the often linear pay scales in the private sector.
How does it scale?
Let's say one quantum provides one unit of salary, enough for all basic needs. Then two quanta, like 4 hours a day or 4 days a week, might pay three units. Three quanta, getting closer to part-time, pays five units. Four quanta pays seven units. Five quanta, a full-time public commitment, pays nine units.
Wow, so dedicating yourself full-time to public service earns nine times the basic survival standard. That's a serious incentive.
Exactly. It attracts talent and dedication for managing the complex aspects of the public thing while still guaranteeing complete autonomy and dignity for those doing just one quantum.
What about people with dependents? Children, elderly parents?
That's covered. An additional quantum is a right for anyone primarily responsible for the care of another person who needs it.
So a parent gets an extra quantum's worth of support automatically.
Yes, ensuring they can meet the dependent's needs without sacrificing their own basic security or being forced into excessive private work. Caring for dependents is recognized as vital work, often within the private sphere, but supported by the public system.
This whole system basically dismantles the traditional work-leisure conflict.
Completely. It replaces it with a fluid alternation between public work for security and contribution, and private natural activities for enterprise, creativity, family, rest.
And if this attractive public work option always exists,
then the state doesn't need to micromanage private businesses. No need for minimum wage laws, working hour regulations, mandated holidays.
Because private employers have to compete.
They have to compete with the baseline security, dignity, and free time offered by the public work quantum. If they want workers, they need to offer something compelling, better pay, more interesting work, whatever. The choice truly rests with the individual.
Okay, so we have the definition of the spaces, the limited role of the political, and these two utopian proposals, universal languages and universal public work. What are the main dangers or limits?
Well, the source argues the general failure of politics throughout history comes from not respecting these limits, from the political trying to do too much, overreaching its bounds.
Failing to stick to just managing the public thing.
And therefore, failing to properly defend it from the intrusions of the natural, like ecological collapse it ignores, or the private, like monopolies taking over public infrastructure.
But there must be edge cases, right, where the lines blur.
Absolutely. The source acknowledges the need for jurisprudence legal precedents, specifically at the boundaries between the spaces.
Like your example of pollution.
Exactly. A private factory, private thing, pollutes the public air or water. Public thing. The political must intervene there.
But only at the boundary.
Only to stop the harm to the public thing, not to take over the factory or dictate its internal operations. The intervention has to be surgically precise, defending the commons, not controlling the private.
Okay, but even with these limits, political power is still power. How do we protect citizens from the potential violence of the state itself, even one trying to follow these rules?
The classic answer, which the source upholds, is the separation of powers.
Executive, legislative, judiciary.
Plus, recognizing the distinct powers of the economy, private sphere, information media, partly public, sometimes even religion as separate spheres of influence.
But the source adds a really interesting twist to why separation works. It's not just about checks and balances.
Right. That's important, but the deeper value, it argues, is that separation creates different scenes or stages where power is performed by different characters with different scripts and audiences.
Multiple arenas of action.
Yes. And this encourages the superposition of scenes we talked about earlier. The legislature debates a law, the courts review its constitutionality, the media reports on it, the economy reacts to it.
All these different perspectives and actions overlapping.
And that very overlap, that messy, multi-layered process, is what valorizes the exercise of power. It brings scrutiny, forces justification, reveals consequences. It makes the power itself more valuable, more legitimate, more grounded.
So concentration power is bad not just because it's potentially tyrannical, but because it destroys value.
Precisely. Any concentration in one person, one party, one ideology, one branch of government minimizes that essential superposition of scenes.
And when the value of power collapses because it's not being tested and validated across these different scenes.
The inevitable result, the source argues grimly, is a reliance on institutionalized violence.
Torture, mass imprisonment, re-education camps.
These aren't historical accidents or just the work of uniquely evil individuals. They are the predictable outcome when power becomes concentrated, loses its inherent value through lack of superposition, and must then rely on brute force to maintain control over a devalorized society.
That's a chilling thought. Separation isn't just good governance. It's a bulwark against the devaluation that leads to state violence.
It's essential for preventing political action from becoming blind and violent. The political must limit itself and coexist respectfully with these other centers of power and influence. Trying to control the media or the courts isn't just an abuse of power. It's an act of violence against the system's value.
Okay, let's recap the core utopian propositions then, the three pillars.
One, circumscribe. Strictly limit political action to the public thing, the interface. Know your boundaries.
Two, manage. Build and maintain that public thing so everyone can live, move, and exchange freely with guaranteed ability to enter and exit the public, private, or natural spaces whenever they choose. Secure the interface.
And three, alternation. Replace the work-leisure trap with the fluid possibility of choosing between public work, which guarantees all vital needs via the quantum, and self-directed private or natural activities. Enable autonomy.
And this whole structure is designed to maximize those transitions, that superposition, generating the most value.
That's the goal. Maximum interaction, maximum value, maximum autonomy.
So we started with this crisis of ignorance, this history of political failure, and we end with this incredibly detailed, maybe utopian blueprint built on knowing the political's proper place and function.
And that quantum system is really the linchpin for citizen autonomy, that guaranteed exit option from total dependence on the private market.
But the source itself calls it a utopia.
It does. And it acknowledges that current trends, well, they're going in the opposite direction.
Concentration of power, private interests, blurring with public functions, the digital commons being carved up.
All of that. Actively minimizing the superposition of scenes, devaluing the political process.
Which implies.
The source hints that without a course correction, maybe embracing some of these principles, we could be heading for another new global crisis. Perhaps only after that might structures emerge that are finally based on knowledge, not blindness.
The fundamental takeaway seems to be that real societal health and value come from managing the interaction between the natural, private, and public, not trying to suppress or control them all.
Mm.
Politics needs to know its limited but vital role.
Exactly. Know its place.
Which brings us back to that foundational responsibility. Teaching the universal languages. We talked about math, community languages, and those languages of the five senses, sight, sound, touch, taste, smell. Thinking about our world today, hyper-focused on data and screens. Which of those sensory languages do you think is the most neglected in our public education systems? And how might that specific lack of training be limiting our collective ability to perceive reality clearly and make truly informed, valorizing decisions about the public thing we all share?
Mm-mm. That's a really good question to ponder. Which sense are we collectively least literate in, and what are the consequences of that blind spot?
Something to think about.